No, it was not your Discord going off in the background. That was mine. So. All right, Mike, we've made it all the way to season 11, and they haven't fired us yet. And since they is off, we would have to fire ourselves.
We've made it all the way to season 11 without maths, and I think that's coming to an end tonight.
Yeah, this is true. We did make it that far without math. And look, our math would be off anyway, because we always manage to get out of order at some point. So it's not like we can count to 12 without screwing it up. So yeah, we're at season 11. Welcome back to Mention and Dispatches with the Armchair Dragoons. Usually it seems our season premieres are always sort of me and Mike and whoever we can scrounge up just talking about nothing, because we haven't got a plan in place yet by the time we start recording. This year, thanks to some outside help, we completely broke that tradition. This is all Liz's fault. We don't just have a topic. We have a very directed topic and very specific stuff we're going to cover. And so Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, Liz is here to join us. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, I'm here to ruin everything as usual, this time with math.
Yeah. And not even a math teacher, right? She's like a Latin teacher. She's ruining stuff with math. So
yeah, math is the devil. I don't even know why I brought it into this.
A Latin teacher. Wait, ubi ignis est.
What about the fire?
That's all I remember from Latin class. That's sad.
For the half hour before this, I was actually helping my daughter with her math homework. And so yeah, that was fun. She's doing high school math in middle school, which is fine. Like, she's smart. She can handle this stuff. The problem is I can't. Like, high school math was so long ago that she's rapidly about to get to the point where I have no clue what she's doing anymore. So that's going to be difficult. Yeah. So audience, look, if you're still here, like, you stuck with us for several seasons and we appreciate you. If you're here for the first time, or like you wandered over here from Liz's show and, you know, who the hell are these Dragoons guys? We appreciate you being here. Thank you very much. The Dragoons, we've been around, you know, half a decade now. We just had our fifth anniversary party earlier, a couple of weeks ago as we're recording this. But we've been around doing stuff under other names for almost 20 years now, floating around online, which just, Mike, that makes us feel old, man. That doesn't sound good, does it?
We are old, so.
Yeah. In any event, the reason Liz is here is that she had approached the Dragoons earlier this summer and said, hey, I got this crazy idea. Are you guys interested in maybe helping with this? And because we're just as crazy as she is, we said, sure. So Liz, talk to us a little bit about the idea behind this survey, where it came from, what you were interested in trying to get at, and sort of the genesis that got us to the point where we're actually like putting a Google form out there and saying, hey, people, come fill this out.
Yeah, so I'm an enthusiastic solo gamer. So if you've consumed anything from my channel, Beyond Solitaire, it's called Beyond Solitaire for a reason. I love solo games. And, you know, I'm a very enthusiastic follower and commentator on the People's Choice Top 200 list every year, which is managed by Kevin Erskine. He is a fabulous person, a great gamer, just an absolute delight. And he's great at handling all the data. So I absolutely love the People's Choice Top 200 list. But if you listen to Kevin and me, especially commenting on the People's Choice Top 200 list on BoardGameGeek, we complain endlessly about how all the war games keep dropping down the list or dropping off. And so I wanted to see what wargamers thought. So, you know, the fact is wargame groups online are huge and the solo wargame groups are enormous. I think there's like 24,000 people in the Solitaire Wargamers Facebook group. And so the People's Choice Top 200 list is great, but I felt like it was missing, I guess, input from some of the most enthusiastic solo gamers out there, and those would be wargamers. And so I wanted to get a list that kind of showed what they were thinking, what we were all thinking. And so I approached you because I, again, suck at math. So I needed to convince someone to do the math for me. And you walked into my trap, and here we are.
And found the journalism guy to do the math.
It's still better than my math.
I'm
still working on Roman numerals over here. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm really excited by this project because I wanted to have a list that covered kind of historical and war games. So given the lovely arguments that I don't want to get into tonight about what is a war game and all that, I actually like what we did with this survey. Just we left it open. If it's a game that's about history, specifically a war game in your mind, or just a historical, whichever you want, and you're playing it by yourself, it was fair game for this survey. And so that was something that I'm really glad we did, because I think we got a cool spread. We got a really cool list.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that was good about the way in which we described all this, and this is something that I'm sure is near and dear to Mike's heart as well, is that it was one of the key pieces, one of the caveats that we put right up front was these don't have to be purpose designed solitaire games. If you're playing by yourself, even if you're playing multi-handed for something that doesn't have an inherent solitaire design to it, that's fine. Do it anyway. And we're cool with that. Because, Mike, I mean, that's what you do a lot on My Own Worst Enemy. Like, you're multi-handing normal war games, right?
We've done shows in the past talking about solitaire gameplay. And I think I've stated that I actually prefer games that are not solitaire only, because I prefer to play them two-handed a lot of times. In fact, I'm going to be posting the final episode of Triumph and Tragedy tomorrow on the channel. And it's, you know, turn 10. And I had a blast playing that. Just the narrative gameplay aspect, I love it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's tomorrow as we are recording this, it's like a week and a half ago by the time anybody's hearing this. So folks looking for that whole Triumph and Tragedy playthrough, go hit Mike's channel on My Own Worst Enemy. It's linked over on our war game page, on our main page. It's like Wargaming Network, I think is what the tab is called. That's got Mike's YouTube channel among several others. So you can find it over there. So, you know, that idea of any game is a solitaire game if you really want it to be, you know, we, again, didn't want to limit folks. If you're playing by yourself, that's fine. We're cool with that. So,
yeah, I think that's standard, especially in wargaming. And I think that honoring that is really important. If you're going to make a list that's by and for people who like war games, then including that kind of solo play makes a lot of sense. Also, I mean, I'm great at the mind. I don't know about y'all.
Sure. I'm just schizophrenic enough to pull off solo multi-handed games like that. So. We're going to take a bit of a left turn here. Just this is going to sound overly academic, but I want to make sure that we get these pieces of it out there. Anybody that's ever read an academic paper knows what's coming next, right? This is the methods section of the paper. Like, we're the description of sort of what we did and how we did it. We built a form in Google Form, or in Google Forms, that we put out there as our survey collection tool. We kind of did it on the honor system. Like, we didn't ask people to log in, because not everybody's got a Google account and people don't want one, and that's a pain in the ass anyway. So we did ask folks kind of on the honor system, sort of don't stuff the ballot box and just send us one reply, and that's fine. And by and large, it looks like that's what people did. People tended to do that. We did ask about email addresses just in case we wanted to get in touch with you with a follow-up question or a clarification. And I'm not sure we actually did email anybody for a clarification. I did hassle our buddy Brian for putting some boneheaded responses in. But other than that, like, they were clear, they were just dumb. So we sort of picked on Brian for that a little bit. So we asked for people's top five. And one of the things that we did with this is that we asked people to specifically paste in the link of the game entry from Board Game Geek so that we could keep the data consistent. That way we weren't having to parse through 12 different ways of misspelling something, and we could get a link to a specific game instead of trying to figure out which edition of John Company you were talking about, or which one of the many different Dan Versen Warfighter games you're talking about. Like, we could get a specific game and know with a reasonable amount of reliability what you were pointing to. And Liz, as you saw going through the data afterwards, I think that definitely made a difference.
Yeah, I think it helped. You know, one of the things I did before asking you to help me with this list was I actually talked to Kevin Erskine, who runs the People's Choice Top 200. And, you know, he's got like this whole Microsoft Access thing going on. It's pretty amazing, honestly. But one of his biggest complaints is that he receives his entries in the form of a geek mail, and people just list their favorite game. But if you put Hoplomachus, it's like, okay, well, is that Rise of Rome? Now it's like, well, do you mean Victorma Remastered, or do you mean like the old one? What does that mean? And I feel like making people put in a link, there were still some answers and responses that were a little bit head scratchy, but yeah. by and large, it was much clearer what people were trying to communicate because they had to choose a link.
Yes. Yeah, that did definitely help. And so we were able to collect that with a reasonable amount of reliability. We left the survey up for about 6 weeks total. There was a flurry of activity at the very beginning, and then there was a flurry of activity in the middle when we both started posting and reminding people, hey, this is still going on. And there was another flurry of activity right at the end when we told people, hey, this is getting ready to wrap up. We probably could have cut out weeks 2, 3, and 5 and gotten just as many people responding to it. Because people tended to respond when we said something about it. They went, oh yeah, I should go do that. And then that's when people kind of got back to us.
I'll be real. I was bad. I put in my own entry on like August 30th, a day before we closed it.
You wanted to make sure you had maximum amount of data gathering time for your own assessment. And that's fair.
I'm just extremely wishy-washy on in terms of top list. I'm really bad at it. My top list probably changed day to day.
Yeah.
That's the thing, right? Your top, and that maybe we'll talk about this, but yeah, your whatever you like now isn't what you're going to like a year from now, 6 months from now, maybe even a week from now, you know?
Well, and I think we'll probably do this again next summer and see what the differences are. And
I really hope so, honestly.
And let folks come back with, oh yeah, I like this one better. In some cases, like there's new games coming out all the time. And so you're going to expect to see some movement there. But some people may not have voted for something because they haven't had a chance to try that 20-year-old game yet and finally get around to it. So what we did with the scoring, so we asked everybody for a top five and we required 5. And we'll talk about that here in just a second, but we got a top 5 from everybody and we rank order scored them. If it was your top one, that one scored a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 in descending order from there. And then we added up the aggregate scores, kind of like, you know, voting for the top 25 in college football or something. We added up the aggregate scores to get the list. And then we also asked a couple of additional questions here, you know, towards the end of it. And they were completely optional. We did not require responses to those. But there was, how long have you been playing? How much of your gaming is solitaire? You know, how often do you get a chance to play with other folks? We asked a couple of those questions. We did also ask the question of sort of, where did you find out about this? Because we were kind of curious where people heard about it. And so if you go take a look at the Dragoon site, you will see those charts that kind of break down the kinds of games folks are looking at. And it also gives you the entire list of all of the data that we got. So you're going to see all of the games with the scores that they got and how many times they got any vote in any place in that top 5. And then what their average score was. So, you know, the average overall ranking, obviously, like the one game that got a single first place vote, that average is going to look high, but it's artificial because it's only one person voting. But I think by and large, all of our top 25, 30 or so had pretty high averages and all had pretty significant scores in there. And so that was pretty cool to see. So,
and when you see these numbers, you can scratch your heads along with us.
Well, yeah, that's that always happens. That always happens.
This is part of the fun.
So yeah, so we got the list all piled up. We got everybody's top 5, rank ordered them 5 down to 1, added up all those scores based on the 5s to the 1s, and our number one game on the list is, artificial drum roll, Liz, number one game is
D-Day at Omaha Beach. Yeah.
And that sound you hear is me scratching my head, but go ahead.
You know, I totally missed an opportunity there. I should have said Mage Knight just to...
That would have been awesome. Yeah,
everybody throwing their iPods across the room or their phones across the room. Yeah.
Number one war game, Mage Knight. Yeah.
Battletech. Yeah.
But, you know, with this wargaming bunch, you could have said something like Bayonets and Tomahawks and got the same reaction out of them. So, or Risk. Or
yeah. To Liz's point from earlier, by and large, we asked folks sort of, you know, war or historical games. And again, you know, we got a little bit of pushback on this here and there online, a couple of curmudgeons griping about it. The truth is, like Liz pointed out earlier, we didn't want to get into trying to parse the difference between that's a war game, that's not a war game. Like if somebody's got Twilight Struggle in their list, great, have Twilight Struggle in their list. You know, yeah. Is you know, Gandhi and Fire in the Lake are both part of the Coin series. We didn't want to have to parse the difference between Fire in the Lake's about an actual, you know, war zone going on, whereas Gandhi is kind of not. But they're both still Coin games. They're both historical conflicts. yeah, we didn't want to have to rule those things in and out. And to be fair, like the majority of what we've got on here is not, nobody's voting for the 18 double X games, despite a couple of threats here and there.
Yeah. And I will add, there were entries in here. I was like, why did you put that in the survey? Are you out of your mind? But that, you know, when you leave a survey open for people to respond, you're just going to get responses that in your personal opinion are crackpot responses.
Yeah. You're still going to have a little noise here and there.
But I would say overall, people understood the assignment, as it were, and we got very reasonable choices. And, you know, this list, I think, showcases a really strong range in terms of weight, novelty, topics. We did a good job as a community with this list, I would say.
I think you're right. So our working from 10 down to 1, we'll do our top 10 in backwards order. And we're not going to, like, you know, play a music video for each of the top 10 or anything crazy like that. We're just going to, here's our top 10. And then we'll discuss a little bit. So at number 10 was the Hunters, German U-boats at war, 39 to 43. At number 9 was John Company, second edition. At number 8 was RAF Battle of Britain, 1940. Tied for number 6. We had two of them in there. That's why we don't have a 7, because we had two ties at number 6. We had Enemy Action Ardennes and Mr. President, the American Presidency, 2001 to 2020. We had Skies Above Britain was number 5. Number 4 was Fields of Fire. Number 3 was Pavlov's House, our buddy David Thompson. One of Liz's co-designers, actually. You know, we'll talk about that later.
Indeed.
Because Night Witches isn't on this list, but you got to kind of release it first, right?
Nobody's played Night Witches. David and me and some people at Circle DC, so...
No. Hey, some of us got a game in at Buckeye Game Fest.
That's right. I don't know why you didn't put it number 1, Brant. No kidding.
Because I didn't vote in my own survey. I admire you for voting in your own survey. I find it a little cheesy. So I generally don't vote in my own survey.
Well, you're also not much of a solo gamer. No offense.
I am not as much of a solo gamer as the two of y'all. That is absolutely fair.
There's some questions as to whether or not he's even a war gamer. So.
Oh, bite me. All right. Number 2 was Pax Pamir second edition. And number 1 was D-Day at Omaha Beach.
God, I hope Decision Games is ready to get that reprint out.
No kidding. Yeah,
and hurry up, y'all.
What's interesting is several of the D-Day series all showed up on this list. So it wasn't just D-Day at Omaha Beach. Peleliu was on here. So there's a couple of, you know, I think all of the different D-Day solo games in that series from Decision are on here somewhere.
Yeah. Tarawa is in the top 20. And actually, one of our entrants, one of the surveyors bought it's actually put a different D-Day game for each of his top 5, if I remember.
Yes, that
you know, and I have to wonder that if some of this wasn't people, so there are solitaire only games as we talked about. And I'm just wondering if some of this wasn't people just don't know how many solitaire only games or war games are out there. And maybe, you know, everybody knows D-Day at Omaha Beach, the D-Day series from Decision. And maybe some people just thought, I know that game, I'm just going to put it in here.
Maybe I'd like to think that people were actually voting for stuff that they played, because
I think they tried, but you did give them 5 slots to fill out and you told them to fill all 5 out.
Well, yes, but going back to a point that, you know, Liz and I have joked about a little bit over the last several weeks, like if you don't have 5 favorite solitaire games to put on this list, this probably wasn't the survey for you, right? You're not the target audience, and that's okay. Like, there's nothing wrong with you just moving right on past the survey that doesn't apply to you. That's fine. Like, I'm not asking a vegetarian to rank their top 5 fast food burgers. It's okay. You know, move on. Don't worry
about
it. Although,
I am hoping people see the results of this and then go get 5 solitaire war historical games and give them a shot.
Yeah. Yeah,
but actually, absolutely. Okay, so that actually leads me to a question that I have for y'all, which is, of the top 10 that we have, how many of these would you recommend to somebody who has not necessarily played a war or historical board game before and is curious, as opposed to somebody who's already in the choir?
Me, I would recommend none of these to a first-time solo war gamer.
I think Pavlov's House is fine.
Pavlov's House for sure.
Well, yeah, maybe. I haven't played Pavlov's House. Sorry, David. But,
and not just maybe, because our buddy Jim Ozarski's on one of the counters. Here's what I would counter with, Liz. I'd counter with two particular questions. One, what period of history are you interested in? Because if you're interested in ancient Rome, I'm not recommending the Hunters to you, no matter how good of a game it is. So what period of history might you be interested in? The other thing is there are different kinds of solitaire games where something like the Hunters is a little more narrative driven. It's almost sort of, you know, choose your own adventure with a little more bookkeeping, as opposed to something like Pavlov's House that's a little more map encounter and procedural oriented on, you know, on kind of this tableau display in front of you, as opposed to something, like I said, it's a little more narrative oriented, that's more trying to tell you a story as opposed to fighting through a specific scenario. So what are the kinds of things you're interested in is really what I would counter.
So that's part of it, but under no circumstances would I tell a new wargamer to go pick up Fields of Fire.
Oh God, no.
No.
Oh, and God, I also under no circumstances would tell a non-masochistic human being to go pick up Mr. President. I have actually, you know, I'm still kind of processing Mr. President. I'm not unhappy with Mr. President, but the setup time alone is massive. Like, well, this is not like, hey, buddy, it's your first war game here. Try Mr. President. Like, that's a terrible idea.
One of the best quips I saw about Mr. President actually was, you know, that great indie game release, Mr. President. And somebody said, what do you mean indie game release? It's GMT. Yeah, it was self-published. For those that don't know, it was designed by the guy that owns GMT Games, right? So it's a self-published game. That is a factually accurate description of Mr. President.
So I think Brant is right. I think the first thing you're going to ask somebody that wants to get into solo wargaming is, first and foremost, what is your area of interest? What time period appeals to you the most? That's the first thing you got to know. And then, like Brant said, you know, do you want to play a narrative game, or do you want to play a game that is more, you know, you're trying to win, or you're trying to fight a battle and win? Based on the feedback you get, then you can guide somebody as to what they might be interested in. But these top 10, there's none of these I would recommend to someone, except maybe Pavlov's House, which I have not played.
Yeah, well,
Pavlov's House is, if you've played a game, like if you've played hobby games, you'd be fine with Pavlov's House. Yeah. I actually recommend it pretty frequently for people who are already hobby gamers who want to try a war or historical, because if you've played, you know, games that aren't Scrabble, you will be okay.
Yeah. Honestly, if you put enough of the expansions on Castle Panic, you have exceeded the complexity of any of the Valiant Defense series, right? Vanilla Castle Panic is easier than the Valiant Defense series. Once you start putting some expansions on Castle Panic, you have now exceeded the complexity of any of the Valiant Defense series. And for folks that may not know what those are, Pavlov's House, Lanzarote Ridge, Soldiers and Postman's Uniforms, Castle Itter, they're the ones that David Thompson has designed, as they all kind of use the same solo mechanism where it's a tower defense mechanism, right? It's the Valiant Defense series. So it's a bit of a tower defense mechanism where the AI sort of procedurally functions for you. There is the ability to kind of adapt it a little bit to some two-player play, which can help ease a new wargamer in if you have another person kind of playing the AI, an experienced wargamer sort of playing the AI to help walk them through how those mechanics work. Could definitely be a great on-ramp for a new war. So, but that's what you're looking at. So yeah, overall though, I think the top 10 does cut a pretty good swath through a variety of wargaming. It's mostly solo stuff, but there's a couple of things in here that are multiplayer games that people were playing as a solo player. And we do, it's World War II heavy, but that's because that's the wargaming world, right? The wargaming world is World War II heavy. But it's not World War II exclusive either. So that's nice. You know, I do think we cover a bit of ground here. I do think you're right, though, Mr. President, probably a little bit of recency bias in that. It'll be real interesting next summer to see if that one still holds up in the top 10. So,
yes.
Do we want to go on to the next 10, or do we want to keep talking about the top 10?
Elizabeth, I just want to say one thing, which is it's really interesting to see both of the Ricky Royal Whirligig solo modes in here, Paxmere and John Company in top 10.
Yeah. And nice. And of note, both of those are the second editions in here, which included like the solo bots in the those editions that weren't present in the first editions, or I think a little more refined solo bots. One of the things that that we didn't do as a part of the data analysis, good on-ramp to that. When we were doing the data analysis, we asked people for the URLs to the games, and we did not try to interpret or combine URLs in any way. We didn't try to interpret differences between them. If somebody voted Pax Premier second edition instead of Pax Premier first edition, we stuck with exactly what they voted for and did not try and infer any meaning behind one or the other. As an example, the Thunderbolt Apache Leader solo games that were designed by Dan Versen, somebody put the link to the original GMT edition. Somebody else put the link to the Dan Versen games edition like 15 years later. We did not combine those two because we didn't want to make the assumption that somebody just grabbed the first thing that they found, or that somebody like very intentionally put that edition of that game in there. So if you're looking through the data and you see a couple of similar titles or different editions all in here, that's why we didn't want to make that call.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
you know, John Company is an example of that's a multiplayer game that somebody's playing, you know, multi-handed as a solitaire game.
No, definitely not. Ricky has a solo mode in Nightbox. So what's going on is that PAX Premier and John Company in second edition have excellent solo modes that are done by an expert.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that those would be the editions that are appearing here.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So our next 10 is actually a next 11. We had a tie at number 20. So both Enemy Action Kharkov and Combat, a pair of recent Compass Games releases, both tied at number 20. Number 18 is Fire in the Lake. Again, the coin games do have solo bots with them now, but I think there are a bunch of people, and there's at least one person on Twitter who's pretty prominent talking about it, plays coin games multi-handed. She does not use the bots very intentionally. She prefers to play them multi-handed.
Yes.
And then tied at number 18 with Fire in the Lake was Atlantic Chase. So we had another tie in our top 21 right there with Atlantic Chase. 17 was Field Commander Napoleon. 16 was Warfighter, the World War II tactical combat card game. I'm always going to make sure to get the entire full length name of that one out there. I will never simply refer to it as Warfighter. Number 15 was Resist. Again, hey, David, doing solo stuff. 14, Stalingrad, Advance to the Volga, 42-43. 13 was Navajo Wars. And then we had a tie at number 11, so that knocks out both 11 and 12. D-Day at Tarawa, so another one of the Butterfield D-Day series. And the venerable solo classic Ambush was in there at number 11. And again, people put in just the base Ambush. I don't recall seeing any of the Ambush expansions in here, but I'd have to go back and take a closer look at some of the further down ballot votes. So in that next, actually 11, not just 10, Mike, does anything jump out at you as, oh my God, how is that up there? Or, oh my God, how is that not in the top 10?
None of these should be in the top 10. I don't think there's any that I look at and say, no, I can't see why this is in this response. No.
Yeah.
And I think mean, a maybe bunch they're, of these they're, are, say, maybe are, they're a little higher up than I would have thought some of these, but
yeah. Well, I think what you're seeing here also is this is still a lot of purpose designed solo games. So
yeah, for sure. It's very interesting that World War II Warfighter is like the champion among warfighters that appeared in our survey. It's like, that's clearly crowd favorite for now.
A lot of people love Warfighter, the tactical combat card game.
Yeah, but there's like modern, and there's, you know, there's different warfighters. Yeah. And so World War II Warfighter is clearly like the warfighter.
Did Pacific show up in this? Did Pacific show up in this?
It's in there somewhere.
Okay.
One of the reasons I'm always referring to it as the World War II tactical combat card game, or the modern tactical combat card game as it may be, is that longtime listeners know that back in 05, 06, 07, I actually published a series of games called the Warfighter series that are not these that Dan stole the name and ran off with, and has never acknowledged the fact that that series was already published. And I actually got in a pissing contest with somebody one time online. They were, well, how's he supposed to know? It was on the cover of fucking Paper Wars magazine, right? It was covered in Armchair General magazine. It's not like it snuck up on anybody. They were there. They'd been there for a while.
Scandal.
Yeah.
But he's over it now. So he's okay.
Yeah, I'm totally over it.
It clearly is over.
Let me take some more blood pressure medicine here.
So the other thing I thought was really interesting, so I'm not surprised that Ambush is this high up, but I do, if you are somebody who is listening to this because you're interested in the list, you're not going to be able to get a copy of Ambush free easily.
Not easily. Not cheap.
No.
Well, yeah, actually, getting a copy of Base Ambush isn't that hard if you're willing to spend some money on it. You can find copies. They're just pricey. The challenge you will have is getting any of the Ambush expansions. Those are the ones that are hard as hell to find.
See, I'm just hashtag blessed because David Thompson offloaded his copy onto me.
Ah.
So yes. I just...
David Thompson, he's just too damn nice.
He really is nice. Like, he's actually nice. I say this as somebody who has routinely met with David Thompson at 4 a.m.
It's not what it sounds like, folks. They're working on a game design together.
It's just when we're both awake to get on Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah. So that's our top 21 is, you know, again, it's a little World War II heavy. It is mostly things that are in print. It's mostly Compass GMT Decision, with a smattering of some other stuff thrown in here and there. You know, a couple of David Thompson designs, yay, a couple of John Butterfield designs. Actually, I have a handful of John Butterfield designs in here. But that's what we had for our top 21, because we had a tie down there at number 20. And overall, not a bad list. Not, you know, I think all of them are justifiable under current circumstances. Again, is Mr. President going to stand the test of time? Remains to be seen. But would I be surprised that Mr. President popped up on one of these lists when it was sort of the new hotness over the summer? Not really. You know, look, Ghostbusters is an objectively bad song, and it was all over the airwaves in 1984. So you're sort of stuck with it, you know?
So I'm just going to, my takeaway from this, everybody, is that Brant is saying that Mr. President is the same quality as Ghostbusters, the song.
That's I'm not saying that at all.
I'm not saying that. It is really interesting to see. This list is such a fascinating mix of new and old. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ambush by modern hobby game buying standards is ancient.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, a lot of these are older classics by, you know, the standards of people who are, you know, going to game fairs and just buying a bunch of new stuff every summer.
Yeah.
I think that with the Wargamers, it's a little different in that there's a lot of older guys and gals that have been wargaming for quite some time. And they hang on to some of these titles like it's, you know.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
We are going to talk about that just a bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, well, okay,
taking a look at the next nine, right, to get us all the way out to number 30. We actually had several ties in the mid-20s range, counting our way up at this point. So number 22 was Stilicho, Last of the Romans. 23 was Votes for Women, which includes a dedicated solo bot in there. 20, I think I might have mislabeled this on my document here. 24, tied for 24, was Halls of Hegra and Falling Sky, the Gallic Revolt Against Caesar. So we're seeing another coin game pop up on the list here.
Yeah, and another new hotness.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a couple years. Oh,
Halls of Hegra.
I was about to say, Falling Sky is a couple years old. But yeah, I see where you're going with Halls of Hegra. Tied at 26, we had Cuba Libre, another coin game, and B-17 Queen of the Skies.
Another oldie goldie.
Yes. Tied at 28. A Most Fearful Sacrifice, The 3 Days of Gettysburg, and Europa Universalis, The Price of Power. Both pretty new games. I'm willing to bet Most Fearful Sacrifice stands the test of time more than Europa Universalis does.
I would put money on that bet.
Liz, you covered Most Fearful Sacrifice on your channel, right? Did we didn't lose Liz, did we? She's probably taking a drink of coffee or something. Oh my goodness. She's still here. She's making noise. We'll let her answer when she comes back to the mic here. And then tied at number 30, Skies Above the Reich and B-17 Flying Fortress Leader. So we had two of the B-17 procedural games both make it into the top 30. So
I think the one that stands out for me here is Europa Universalis.
Yeah.
It's kind of out of place, perhaps, maybe.
Maybe. All right. Do we have Liz back?
I'm back. I had an internet drop. I've returned.
Oh my goodness gracious me.
You must have Breeze Line.
No. Don't, because if Aardwolf's listening, he's now screaming at his speakers. We just finished running through that top 30. Liz, I was asking, you covered Most Fearful Sacrifice on your channel, right?
Me?
Yes.
No, I have not.
No.
My last Civil War game that I covered was In Magnificent Style, Pick a Charge.
That's the one I was thinking of, was In Magnificent Style.
But I just want to say, I'm so pleased to see Europa Universalis this far up. The solo of this game is nuts, but the game itself is actually really good. If you're willing to learn all of those rules, it's very enjoyable. So I'm pleased other people out there enjoying it too.
I'm laughing because when you dropped off, I told Brant that the one that sticks out to me the most as being out of place was Europa Universalis in this, but not because it's a bad game, but because, you know, you go back to the war game thing and it's like,
this is a war and historical games list. Europa Universalis, regardless of your feelings about its accuracy, is meant to simulate the course of European history. And I think that it does, with some caveats, an excellent job.
Yeah. And I would love to play this solo. I really would. I just don't have it.
Well, you know, if only we had somebody who ran a solo gaming channel that could, you know, throw it on a table and show it off.
That'd have to be a big table. It is not a small game.
It's not as bad. It's a terrible Space Hog, but it's not as bad in solo, actually, because of the Automas.
Yeah. Or you know, Mr. President, where you need an aircraft carrier deck to set it up.
I don't know how I'm ever going to film that.
Yeah.
I have it, and I have the same concern. I really don't know how I'm going to put that on a table. It may have to be Tabletop Simulator.
Oh, God. Is there a tabletop simulator, Mr. President?
I think I did see a module for that.
You need a 48-inch monitor for it, but sure.
Would it destroy your drive? My God.
You would have to do like Jim does, Cyrano, and you would have to create a table that's like 20 feet by 30 feet in virtual terms to put that thing on.
Oh, dear God. I don't know. I kind of want to try it now, though.
So we're not going to count past the top 30 on this. Folks that want to see the rest of the list, go hit the website, right? Go hit armchairdragoons.com. You're going to see the rest of the list there. A couple of things I do want to bring up. One of the things that you'll note on the chart is that one of our stats is the straight count stat. And that is the number of times that game was mentioned at all in any of the five positions. And it won't surprise folks to know that the ones that were mentioned the most are the ones that are kind of trending their way, bubbling up toward the top of the list. And we've got every game that was mentioned at least double digit times is in the top 25 somewhere. And all of them are at the top of the list, except Falling Sky is a little further down. And really, that's just sort of indicative of a bunch of people liked it, but liked it lower in the list. Overall, Liz, I don't remember. Do you remember how many total numbers of games we had mentioned? What did we end up with? 481 different titles were all mentioned in the top five somewhere. That's a lot of games. That's
a lot of games.
Yeah,
I've got a lot of ideas just looking at what other people suggested. So purely selfishly, the others I wanted to do this list is because I like seeing what other people put so that I can then get ideas for what I should try.
Go figure out which games you should be playing, huh?
So. Yeah. Why would I listen to people who aren't experts at playing a bunch of war? Like, I could just let everybody else tell me what's good and get some ideas.
Yeah.
The 11th season of the Armchair Dragoons podcast, mentioned in Dispatches, is graciously supported by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. A huge thank you to Chet Bell, Hellcat6, Patrick Geraghty, Fred Stogg and his walking companion, Mike Quigley, Joseph Knorr, Trep Corey, Stagger Wing, Mark Talk, and Kevin Bertram for their support of the Armchair Dragoons, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming content on the web. You too can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
We're going to pull up one last thing that we're going to talk about here because we got to kind of keep this podcast a little shorter. Just folks got stuff they got to go do tomorrow. So your debut for the season is going to be a little shorter for you this time.
It's a gift.
Well, and there'll be more coverage on this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's our show, there's Liz's show, there's the article on the website. We got the Geek List over at BGG. All of them are linked here on this podcast. So there's plenty of stuff that you can follow up on. It's just some folks I think are used to hour and a half to 2 hour marathon podcasts at this point. The editor is very happy to have some shorter ones every now and then. But just looking at a couple of those optional questions that we asked folks at the end, one of the ones we asked was, what's your favorite type of wargaming media content and pre-recorded video in terms of like reviews and how-tos and playthrough kind of stuff, was 43, almost 44% of the responses. And I think some of that might've been slightly biased towards where people found out about these things. And folks that are fans of the solo content are looking at solo channels like both of your channels, which don't do a ton of live stuff, but do a ton of pre-recorded video. So,
yeah, I was actually very surprised by the fact that only 5.6% of respondents said that they liked live video the best, compared with the proportion of media people who are currently creating live video and like how hot streaming seems to be. I was fascinated to see that because you'd think that streaming would be super hot, given this seems to be what a lot of people do.
Well, but yes and no. In the war game space, how many live streamers do we actually have? Right?
Probably not many. Not unless you want to count Edward from Heavy Cardboard, maybe.
Maybe.
Sometimes.
Gary's got two shows a week, the one he does himself and the one he does with Dan.
Yep.
Moe's got a show once a month. Stuka Joe's pre-recorded. Player's Aid's pre-recorded. Both of y'all are pre-recorded.
Well, now wait a minute. Stuka Joe has done live streams.
He's done some. I'm not saying he doesn't do any.
Yeah, no, it is rare.
The bulk of what he's doing is recorded stuff.
You know who does a ton of live stuff that's great? It's Fred Serval over at Homoludens.
Fred does a bunch of live stuff. Fred also does pre-recorded stuff.
He does.
So he kind of straddles that line. The live stuff is a riot. If you've never tuned into one of Fred's live shows, they are a blast. They're a lot of fun. It's just they're always at 3 o'clock in the afternoon here in the U.S. because Fred's over in Europe. So you got to kind of play hook. Well, Mike doesn't have to play hooky. The rest of us have to play hooky to be able to watch Fred's shows. I did find it interesting. So the next two highest numbers in there were written online content. So like reviews and analysis sites, similar to what we mainly do on our front page at the Dragoons. And Mike, go ahead, make the joke.
What front page?
Exactly. All right. And then the next most popular one was podcasts at 12.5%, with independent online forums right behind that.
That shocks me.
That wasn't higher?
That it was that high. Yeah. And it maybe things like ConSim World and Board Game Geek is why it's up there.
Maybe.
That's what I suspect, yeah. But, yeah. You know, I mean, the board game Facebook groups and stuff are also very active.
That's true.
Yeah, but the social media pie slice is only 4% of the responses.
Yeah, it's because you put short form / high interactivity. People don't want short form. We're Wargamers. We like to do things all day.
Agreed. But if you go look at the Wargamers group on Facebook, nobody's writing novels. You know, look at the Wargamers on Twitter, nobody's writing novels. And if you get more than a paragraph in a Discord post, man, you're like Shakespeare. So...
Unless you're talking to ChatGPT, then it's different.
Well, there's that. So I don't think there's really any conclusions you can draw from this that are generalizable to Wargamers as a whole. I think it's interesting in being descriptive of the audience that responded to this, that a lot of them are fans of pre-recorded video. And I think part of that is there's a lot of pre-recorded video covering solo games out there, whether it's the two of y'all, whether it's Wayne, whether it's, Stuka Joe, who invented a solo card driven game system, there's just a bunch of folks that are doing video on solitaire gaming. So it doesn't really surprise me that's where solitaire gamers might go to get info.
No, I do think you have to consider these numbers and also, frankly, the content of the list in conjunction with what I think is the most important question that you've asked, which is how long have you been wargaming?
Yeah. So
I was fascinated by this chart.
Here's the thing.
And actually, this is about what I expected.
Yes, but Mike, here's what I'm going to say. It's worse than you think. And here's part of the problem. So the options were less than a year, 1 to 3, 3 to 10, 10 to 25, or more than 25. And to nobody's surprise, the more than 25 ran away with this with almost 54% of the participants. Here's the problem with this, though. And Mike, I'm going to crush your soul a little bit here while Liz laughs at us from afar. 25 years is the late 90s.
I was going to say, where's your more than 50 years?
and it occurred to me afterwards, and Liz and I had this conversation, that what we really needed was a like 40 plus years bucket.
Yeah.
And it would be very interesting to see how that more than 25 breaks down to folks that started playing in the 2000s and folks that started playing in the 70s. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascinating to me. So, I don't feel like a kid, obviously, at 37. But also, if I had been playing for 25 years, I would have had to start at 12.
I started at 8. So.
Oh, my God. So, Brent, you've upset me because, I would be on that 40 plus list. I just...
Yeah. I'm on the 40 plus list.
I actually found a tweet from myself in 2018 that was like, I don't identify as a war gamer, but, and then of course, but I mean, I've been playing war games for, a solid chunk of time now, but nothing like 25 years. But it's really funny, like going from person who plays some war games to war gamer is an evolutionary process as well.
Well, and I will say one of the things that I do think is pretty cool is that, in aggregate, folks playing under 10 years were like 35-40% of the population that replied to this. So, we got 80 something, not quite 90, but about 80 something of our respondents are folks that have been wargaming for under 10 years. And I think that's pretty cool. We've recorded multiple podcasts over the last several years about, the impending death of wargaming and, oh my God, the graying of that. But it's funny, like you go back 25, 30, 40, 50 years ago in some of the magazines, you pull up S&Ts from the late 70s, early 80s, and they're complaining about the graying of the hobby and why aren't kids playing war games. And so I do think it's cool that while we consider and chuckle at the fact that over half of the respondents have been playing for more than 25 years, I think it's cool that we've got 80 something respondents that are under 10 years. And that's neat. Like that, I think that's good. I would be a lot more concerned if our more than 25 year pie slice got bigger than smaller.
Now, see, I wouldn't be surprised either. Yeah, Mike.
The only, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I told you to go ahead.
Oh, okay. The only thing, just I'm looking at this survey now. There's so many surveys we could do. Maybe we shouldn't wait a year to do another one. But another question I would love to ask in conjunction with this question is, do you only play war games or you play war games and board games?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a different kind of survey.
Yeah.
And it is something that we will get to at some point down the line, because the there are plans afoot for the Dragoons to do a couple of different deeper dive research projects. There's one we're actually partnering with some folks at a university up in New Jersey that we're going to start digging into some deeper, more in-depth academic focused kinds of survey research here in the next couple of months. But you're right, Mike, that is definitely a question that would be very interesting to see the results of. I think it's a little beyond the scope of what we were after for this particular exercise.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So
yeah, but I actually feel like there's probably an even larger proportion of people that we maybe could have reached with this survey. You know, I think, you know, there are people who maybe didn't quite feel ready to provide five solitaire war games, but they are playing some.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people who, you know, maybe just saw the survey and thought, oh, well, that's not for me. I'm not a real war gamer. But it takes time to decide that that's what you are.
Yeah.
And I think that as long as we continue kind of bringing people to the hobby in a positive way, that I fully believe that wargaming can grow. You know, historicals are my thing because I feel like there's a lot of cutting edge stuff happening from young designers who are really interesting right now. Yeah. And I feel like that trend is only going to continue. And, you know, I saw somebody who's just a, who I normally view as just a regular old hobby gamer, tweeting something about playing a war game the other day. And I just thought, yes, the normalization of this branch of the hobby, it's happening. It takes time, but it is happening. I don't know the extent to which there will be, you know, a crossing of the streams, but it's definitely more common now, at least based on my anecdata, right?
I think this is probably worthy of a much longer podcast at a later date. And so this is us drafting you into coming back later this season so that I don't have to invent more topics down the line. But I think your idea of sort of kind of wargaming coming back to the mainstream a little bit is interesting, because up until the late 80s, early 90s, when you started to see some of those first European imports coming over, wargaming was the hobby. Like, if you wanted to play any sort of more in-depth strategy game that wasn't Monopoly, sorry, Clue, like the mass market crap you find in Target, if you wanted anything more detailed than that, you were either picking up some sort of fantasy board game from the TSR WotC kind of world, like a Divine Right or one of their mini games like Saga or They've Invaded Pleasantville or something like that, or you were playing war games. Now, heavier ones, lighter ones, whatever. But the idea of non-war game strategy games hadn't fully crossed the Atlantic just yet. So, you know, in the 70s, that's what you did. That was your choice. You know, there wasn't a lot of options. Something like a Catan or a Carcassonne or a Ticket to Ride, like those things just didn't exist. So the idea of sort of people coming back to wargaming as this is kind of a cool thing I can do in addition to other things I'm interested in, like that's almost sort of turning back the clock a little bit, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, all things come full circle eventually, right?
Yes.
So hopefully this is I actually, you know, we could talk a lot about this in the future. You know, there's so much blending now too of, you know, war and historical gaming concepts and things that we're trying to, you know, show through a game with mechanisms that are from, quote, the other side of the hobby.
Well, and I think one of the places where we've seen that idea of not wanting to separate war from historical gaming a little bit, and where, look, quite frankly, we got a little bit of pushback online. We were talking about, you know, war / historical gaming. Oh, great. You know, you guys are clearly after this other crap. No, we're not. But there have been a lot of pretty neat mechanics from the war game world that got adapted for use outside of wargame. And an example of that, the coin series of games, you know, and the first couple of them, Andean Abyss, Cuba Libre, Distant Plain, Fire in the Lake, like, you know, and Liberty or Death, these are shooting wars, right? I mean, this is the games aren't always down at the tactical level where you're putting bullet holes in people, but every one of those was a shooting war somewhere, right? Every one of them had kinetic action in it somewhere. And then you end up with Gandhi, which very much did not.
Yeah, and I mean, people have been trying to make the term waro happen for a while, not because it's a great term, but because But because it's trying to name something that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the kinds of card driven mechanics, some of which, you know, trace back to those early ops event alternative kind of card driven games that came out of the wargaming space. You know, that's one of the ancestors of Votes for Women. You know, that's not to say Votes for Women's a war game necessarily. It is absolutely an historical game and a conflict in the historical world. But a lot of those mechanics come from the wargaming world, which I don't see a problem with that. I think that's cool when other people look at something and go, hey, that's a neat mechanic. I can use it to represent this other thing. Let me run with it and go. The idea of deck building, look, it started with the collectible card game craze, obviously, but to get to the point where you were deck building in a self-contained box, Dominion was the first one to really explode in popularity. But you've seen those deck building mechanics cross over into the wargaming world with Undaunted, with Few Acres of Snow. So, you know, that pollination's going both directions.
Oh, yeah. And that's only a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. More choices is usually better. So we did ask folks how much of your historical or war board gaming is played solo. And look, it's a survey for solitaire gamers. It shouldn't surprise everybody that, you know, the 50 to 75% and the over 75% combined to account for 54% of our responses. Interestingly, 10% of our folks play under 25% of their, you know, war gaming is solo. So we still had folks responding to this, even if solo gaming wasn't their core shtick.
See, I think that's good. Like, solo gaming should be part of a healthy gaming diet.
Yeah.
I think it got really normalized during the pandemic as well.
Yeah. So I'm glad you said it that way. It got normalized. Solo gaming was there before the pandemic. People want to say, oh, the pandemic really, really got solo wargaming off the ground and flying. No. Solo wargaming was going on. Yes. It got normalized more in the pandemic.
We were hipsters. We were there before it was cool, okay?
We were totally cool before it became cool.
There's nothing cooler than playing board games by yourself.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the what percent of your historical war board gaming is played solo, we did have 53 people in the survey, which is just over 20%, come back with all of it. So I did find that a little
amusing. I'm just happy that nobody said none.
Yes, well.
I'm going to vote, but I don't play any solo games.
That wasn't an option. To be fair, we didn't give them that choice.
And that's I think... the people that said all of it, I'm a little surprised at how high that number is.
Just I don't know. I mean, I think you've got the one schlub that lives in a log cabin out on, you know, in Western Nebraska that probably doesn't have another person within 40 miles, much less a particular opponent.
Those are the people that Jim talks about. Yes. That yes. To me, I think that's a very, I think that's what I'm saying. I think that's a smaller group than what's being represented here.
Maybe. And that's also very probably specifically doesn't have internet connectivity.
We did specifically ask how much of your historical / war board game is played solo. So these are absolutely probably people who might play something more mainstream with other people, but yeah, they're just not finding people who want to play something like, I don't know, Empire of the Sun.
Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't ask enough questions to really get it the whether or not that's actually out there, but it's not an unreasonable assumption to make based on what we know of our fellow wargamers.
Many more questions to ask, yes.
So we did ask, how frequently do you get together to play a game on the tabletop, specifically on the tabletop, and not Vassal or TTS or other digital tools, whether it's solo or with other people? We did ask, you know, putting a game on a table, how often does that happen? And folks came, you know, weekly or more frequently was the most common response. So folks are still finding table space to put physical games out there, which I think is great.
Yes. And I'm not going to name who it is or the group of people. There are people that make fun of solo gamers that do nothing but sit in a room by themselves playing Tabletop Simulator or Vassal and never see the other person. So I'm glad you put the question this way.
You're just trying to pick fights, Mike.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Mike's solitude has made us cranky.
Mike is trying to pick a very particular fight there.
No. Just saying.
I sort of feel like the great advantage of solo gaming, though, is that you can have 40% of people say that they're playing weekly or more, because you don't have to wait around for other people to get their life together and play games like they should.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's that famous meme about what do we want? D&D, when do we want it? Well, I can't meet Thursday. How about two Saturdays from now? Yeah, so it applies to working groups as well.
Absolutely.
Which is why we all secretly hate Aardwolf and the fact that he has to turn down weekly OCS games because he can't fit them all in his schedule.
It's true. It's just not fair. Yeah. Not fair.
We did ask folks where they found out about the survey, and the big slices of this pie, obviously, Liz, your channel, because you're a co-sponsor of this and pushed it out quite a bit. Board Game Geek shared in a wargaming group on social media somewhere, shared on Twitter, and Armchair Dragoons were the other big pie slices in all of this. But we did get a pretty good bump from Aardwolf's Lair also. We got almost 20 people say that they found out about it through Gary's content, through some of his different shows. So we did get traffic from a whole lot of different places, which is cool. The usual suspects were the usual suspects, right? I mean, it's our channels plus Board Game Geek, a wargaming group somewhere on social media, and Twitter. Like, those were the sort of main ones that were out there. Interestingly, Consim World was a pretty small slice of the pie. And I don't know if it's just sort of there weren't a lot of solo gamers there interested in responding to this, or that's indicative of its kind of dwindling place in the wargaming media landscape. So
And really, Liz, I just wanted to say this. My own worst enemy actually was the largest place where people found out about this survey, but I had to recuse myself. So that's why you ended up being number one there.
You can tell yourself that, buddy. I'll let you have your dignity. It's fine. Honestly, I'm just so happy that we got like a good variety of sources, because it means there are a whole bunch of people out there who not only participated, I think that we got good numbers for a first run, but you know, I feel like this is a communal thing. Enough different people talked about this in different places, and we got enough people from different sources that I really feel like instead of it just being one person's list, right, it's our list. Makes it fun.
Yeah.
I definitely think that this is very much a group thing, that this is not, you know, in any way proprietary to just, you know, one person or one organization, that this is definitely a community thing that a lot of different folks can claim ownership and participation in, even if we were the ones that crunched the numbers. And I definitely think that that's cool. Something that I was thinking about this, you know, in terms of sort of the sample size, right? We got a little over 250 people replying to this thing, and that's really cool. Like that's a solid amount of solitaire wargamers that got back to us and gave us good data. We probably could have increased the participation if we'd gotten outside of the habitual wargaming channels in order to promote this thing. The concern, of course, is does it turn into just a version 2 of the list that's already out there, that People's Choice Top 200, because we start casting a wider net, but we start bringing in more non-war gamers that are talking about non-war games on that list, to where we start to see Ticket to Ride and the 18 double X's and the things, you know, that just don't belong in a wargaming list because they're not even really all that historically tied together. I'm kind of glad that we didn't get there.
Yeah, I mean, if we do this year on year, it will be interesting to see how the results evolve, and also how we choose to respond, right? Because I always feel conflict between, I have very strong opinions about what should count, because I think we all do. That's why, like, we literally argue with each other about this stuff on the internet. Like, what is it worth or not? I want to have some principles that we stick to. I also don't want to tell people what's what to an extent that's overly invasive.
So
that's always going to be a weird line that we're just going to have to walk if we keep doing this. But so far, again, like, people definitely understood the assignment. Like, I'm looking at most of these submissions were spot on, fantastic. Fantastic choices. Whether you agree about whether the games are good or not, it's everybody knew what to put for the most part.
Yeah, they all fit the appropriate genre that we were looking for.
Yes, with some exceptions, but we're just going to ignore those.
But but remarkably few, and none to the point that I think they had any sort of skewing impact on our data.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. And I was also happy to see a few surprises in here. Like, somebody put Lisboa in here. I think that's arguable. It's a heavy Euro game, but it is deeply informed by history. So, you know, that one, I'd be like, okay, yeah, I could see it. You know, there are others I thought were way off target, but I actually wouldn't say Lisboa was. Not by the criteria that we offered.
Mike, you've seen the whole list. Is there something further down the list below the 30s that jumps out at you that, oh, hey, I'm glad to see that on the list, or, oh, man, how the hell did that get on the list, or why isn't that up higher, or why is that, you know, why isn't that down lower, or whatever?
Well, I haven't had time to look through the entire list, so I'm sure there's some on here that are really going to make me question how they even got on the list. There are, what I'm seeing though, are there's some that are really low that I'm, that shocks me they are so low. And I, as I said before the podcast started, to see, don't tread on me the, as far down as it is. That just, that hurts.
Yeah.
Really does. Because I that is probably my favorite solitaire war game. But like we talked about before, it goes back to, I love the Revolutionary War period. So, you know, it strikes the right chord and it depends on what you like. So kind of shocked to see that one so low. I think it's a fun game. The other oddity was Space Empires 4X. I love to play that one solo.
Yeah, but why would that be on this list?
Because you can play it solo.
Well,
but it's not.
In all fairness, it only three people voted for it. It's down in the 120s.
And so, you know,
that said, it got an identical score to Soldiers in Postman's Uniforms and Night Fighter Ace and In Magnificent Style. And
I get what you're saying though, Liz. Honestly, when I did the survey, I honestly thought we were looking just for solitaire games. So I only put solitaire games. Yeah. So I didn't vote for Space Empires 4X, but I, you know, I see what you're saying there. But yeah, it's a great solitaire game.
Well, the problem for me is that I wouldn't consider it a historical game. Like, you know, personally, I would be interested to see further entries on that in the future.
See, it's a war game.
But yeah, but if you actually read the instructions of the survey, it's quite clear what we were looking for.
I don't read those.
We did say war or historical game.
We said games that actively engage with history in some way.
Okay. I'm sure the universe is so big, I'm sure that somewhere those four empires fought a war.
Now we're in speculative territory.
And then there's the multiverse, so yeah. Somewhere it's got to be history.
That's going to be on the AP exam next year.
Liz, by that criteria, any of the Cold War Ghost Hot games shouldn't be on here.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
I mean, I think that space versus speculative history, I mean, but that's the whole conversation you can have, right? The problem is, if you're making a game, it can't be purely historical or else it's not a game, it's on rails.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So nobody wants that.
But historical grounding, I think, would have to be present for a Cold War game that goes hot, whereas historical grounding is not necessary for something like a space game.
I got you. And you know, and then we start to get into the fuzzy area of like, what do we do with Mississippi Banzai? So, you know, I mean, there's sort of nutty ones all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Are you insinuating that Star Trek isn't real?
Never. I would never do that to you.
I would outright state it, but you know, I'm okay lobbing grenades at people. So something that was noticeable is that a whole lot of DVG's leader series made the list somewhere. It's just a lot of them were kind of far down on the ballot. So we do have, I mentioned Thunderbolt Apache leader earlier. Stuka leader is on here. Sherman leader's on here. There's a whole bunch of that DVG series that are all on there, but a lot of them got down ballot votes. Phantom leader's down there somewhere. IAF leader is down there. So a lot of them did show up. They just didn't show up in sufficient numbers to really, you know, bubble their way up and break through into the top 30 or so. There's a lot of Ben Madison games on here, which I know is going to make me happy. There's a bunch of Ben Madison games on here, but not a lot of them very high on the list. And again, that may just be, you know, stuff being spread kind of thin, but a lot of them in the 30s and 40s. Margaret Thatcher's or Mrs. Thatcher's War is on here. White Tribe is on here. Liberty or Death is on here. So, I mean, there's a bunch of those that did make it in here somewhere. There's a bunch of the David Thompson games, and not just the couple that are up at the top with Pavlov's House and Resist, but also the rest of the Valiant Defense series is in here somewhere. Lansworth Ridge is in here. Soldiers of Postman's Uniforms. Castle Itter.
And I see Pandemic is in here.
Well, it's Pandemic, Fall of Rome. Okay,
look, Pandemic in there. Space Empire
won the Origins Award for best historical game 1 year. You're gonna have a hard time screening it out of this list, whether but, you want to or not.
Yeah, I find it. I mean, Pandemic, Fall of Rome, you could actually talk about as an attempt to discuss Roman history, which is quite interesting.
Yeah,
I have disagreements with the way history is presented, but it is a presentation.
Well, I think we're all going to have disagreements about how history is presented.
Exactly.
One of the things I did find interesting, there is no shortage of games in this list that you absolutely have to play multi-handed, that there's virtually no, even with Stuka Joe's CDG-driven system, it would be very hard to play the Commands and Colors games truly solo without multi-handing it, or any of that you know, the card-driven three zones on the board, you know, board series like Memoir 44 is on here, multiple Commands and Colors on here, Battle Cries on here somewhere. So I mean, there's a lot of those that you virtually have to play multi-handed. I was a little surprised that there weren't more of the States of Siege games and that they weren't higher up on the list. I think if we had done this survey 8, 9, 10 years ago, when Victory Point games still existed and States of Siege games are still getting cranked out on a pretty consistent basis, I think they would have been much higher up. But the impossibility of finding very many of them these days, I think, has definitely cut into their prominence and their popularity. That's my gut reaction on that one. So, but overall, I think it's a cool list. I think there's a lot of fun stuff in here to discuss. Again, we've made the whole list available to folks. Go take a look, draw your own conclusions, see what you think.
Yes, don't take our word for it.
No. And let us know what you think.
Interestingly, when we sorted the list by the average score, And for those, you had to have at least 3 votes to count for the average, because otherwise one person putting their favorite game in a 5 is going to drag that one all the way to the top. Interestingly, there's only one of the games that's up on that high average that made it into the top 10. And that was Fields of Fire. Fields of Fire had an average rating of a 4. And it's actually a higher average rating than the 3 games in front of it, than Pavlov's House, PAX Premier Second Edition, or D-Day at Omaha Beach. All 3 of those got a lot more votes, is how they got up higher on the list. But as an average, Fields of Fire is the highest average rating in the top 20.
It's a game that people really, really love.
Yes.
But now, is that Fields of Fire 1 or 2?
We'd have to go take a look at the link, but I believe it's Fields of Fire 1. I think it's the original base game, because I think we've got elsewhere in there, we've got the other Fields of Fire games.
I suspect you're right, too, especially since I think they just did a rewrite of the entire rule book. So I suspect you're right.
Yeah. So Fields of Fire 1 got 20 votes. Fields of Fire 2 only got a single vote. It's down in the 300s.
So, yikes.
Yeah. Now, one, going back to Liz's point of, oh my God, Fields of Fire is a pain in the ass to learn. It absolutely is a pain in the ass to learn. I'm curious how many of those 20 people that voted for it just have Stockholm syndrome. They're like, damn it, I figured this out. It must be the greatest game ever.
That's sunk cost fallacy right there.
Yes. Yes. I suspect there's probably a couple of votes that are like, I figured this out. I must be a genius. Therefore, this is an awesome game. So there's probably a couple of those people out there. But
I'm also going to assume, though, as high as it is, that there are people who just know and love this game. Like,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is very well regarded by the folks that are big fans of it, and they are enthusiastic about helping guide people through learning it as they want to, as those new people express an interest in wanting to get into it. It is one of those games that is best learned from someone who already knows how to play. but it the folks that love it really love it. We're rapidly, hitting Liz's expiration time here for the evening, but also getting close to what we had committed to for the recording on this one. We're a little over an hour. By the time we edit out me saying a bunch, we'll probably be down closer to an hour. Mike, any last thoughts on the list as a whole, the survey as a whole, kind of the process we went through here and what results we got out of it?
Just that this was really cool. And you know, I hope this is a regular thing with us. There's so many more questions I want to ask. I can see so many different surveys we could do. So there's a lot of surveys I think we need to do. Really interesting, though, and I'm glad to see this, and I hope we do more of it in the future.
Mike, I'm going to point out that for at least 7 straight Dragoons admin meetings under the, hey, content we should look into, I've had, we should be asking some survey questions, but we need to find somebody to take point on this because I'm already overcommitted.
That's true, and I'm still saying
is this
that.
You volunteering to take point on them?
No, I'm saying we should do this.
the very inclusive we. I like it. Yes.
I've learned, look, in 12 or 13 years of running wargaming sites at this point, I've learned that when other people say we, I walk the other way because it inevitably means I will help you the first 20 days or so, and then you're on your own. And then Brant gets stuck holding the bag for everybody else's great ideas.
Well, Brant, thank you so much for being part of this idea with me, because I am so delighted to see this list, because it's just, you know, it makes some of the old things feel fresh again. It shows us what the new hotness in wargaming is right now. You know, I think it'll be a fun thing for all of us to get together and talk about now that it's here. And it just brings me a lot of joy. I'm really hoping that we get a lot of, you know, people who want to, you know, talk about what's on here, talk about why things are the way they are, say, man, I wish I'd voted, and maybe think about doing it next year. You know, I'm hoping this is the start of a fun tradition for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be entertaining to do as we move forward. And now that we've got a process in place and the initial documents that will be a little easier to replicate and kind of use as templates going forward from which we can adjust, right? It's always easier to edit something that exists than to build it from scratch, that I think it'll be a little easier to do going forward. And I think one of the things we need to look at is when we do this, that if we can do it a little earlier in the summer, we've got several of the conventions that we can use to also help promote this as well.
That's true.
So, yeah.
So definitely something I want to look at in the future. So
yeah.
Cool. Well, Liz, thank you very much for finally joining us on Mention and Dispatches here. I know this, you're not new to podcasting, obviously, but this is your first time paying us a visit, and we appreciate you being here and joining us for our season 11 premiere. So thanks for being here.
Oh, yes, man, thanks definitely. For having me on. It's been so fun.
And we're absolutely going to bring you back at some point to talk about other stuff, because like I've still got 3 or 4 different episodes this season that I've got to figure out what we're talking about. So you've already filled in one of them. Let's talk about sort of the circle of life in wargaming and hobby gaming there. And we'll bring you back around for that one later.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
So, Mike, we get to do all this again in like a couple of days as we're getting the first couple of episodes recorded. So yeah, this isn't new stuff for you. We've been doing a whole bunch of this for, you know, 5 years and plus now, you know, going back to previous podcasts as well, but it's great to be back on the air with you and knocking out a bunch of podcast episodes. Again, we're here in the fall, right? I mean, there's a couple of fall traditions we're going to hit. The Compass catalog is going to show up at some point. We're going to spend 2 hours complaining about typos and talking about all the games we want to order and then getting hate mail from Bill about it. Because it inevitably happens. I'm sure at some point we will have some sort of episode bitching about the Charlies, whether the Charlies are actually out yet or not. We'll still complain about them because it's tradition. Like, that's just what we do. And then somewhere in there, we've got the fall assembly coming up. And so for folks who don't know, we've got our first in-person convention. Liz is blowing us off. She's not going to bother to show up. But Mike's going to be there. I'm going to be there. We're going to have a bunch of folks congregating here in North Carolina in late October. And so we're taking over the game store for the weekend and going to be playing war games all weekend and having a great time. We've got Bruce Maxwell's coming to town. Herman Luttman's coming to town. Keith Tracton's coming to town. We're still trying to draft a couple of local guys who are designers into actually showing up, which is a little annoying that we've got to like bug them to show up in their own town. But we're going to have some fun with the fall assembly. And so you'll get some podcasts talking about that and probably some live hits from there as well. Cool. Mike, it's going to be a fun season.
Yeah, I think so.
And not just because we're going to bring Liz back again later. So
cool.
I promise to be charming-ish.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to call it good night as we are recording, but thank you for listening at whatever time of day folks are listening to this podcast. We really appreciate it. So for Fred and his dog, I hope you enjoyed your walk. And everybody else, thank you for joining us on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.